From Iowa Public Radio News, this is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the legislative session. I'm John Pimble. There is a problem at the Capitol. Outside, parts for a scaffolding are loaded in a large metal box. The scaffolding is being built around the Capitol's Golden Dome. Moisture has been gradually seeping through the dome for a couple of years. Experts think the damage was caused by a lightning strike. A crane lifts the steel bars and wood planks 275 feet off the ground to construction workers standing on a ledge near the top of the dome. Last year, legislators set aside $10 million to fix the problem, but repair was held off because the governor's administration wanted the building to look good during last summer's National Governors Association meeting. The work is expected to take 18 months. If all goes according to plan, well before the repair is completed, Governor Branstad will resign and move thousands of miles away to China. He spent much of this week in Washington, D.C., meeting with various government agencies. The day before leaving, he holds his weekly press conference Monday morning. Governor Branstad says he isn't sure when his confirmation to be the U.S. ambassador to China will happen.
I don't have that information, and I've been told that that is the prerogative of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
And what Iowa staff will the governor take with him?
There's a large staff already there, and there might be a few people that I can take with me, but it's a relatively small number. I think the embassy and the five consulates have over 2,000 employees. The embassy is in Beijing, and there's five consulates throughout China.
He says he can speak some Chinese.
I know a few words like ni hao and xi xi.
That means good day and thank you. And he's studying more about the many aspects of his potential new job.
I've worked to learn appropriate pronunciation of names of the Chinese leaders and communities in China and things like that. But I still be the first to tell you, I have a lot to learn. I've been to China six times. But this is a huge responsibility, and I'm going to learn as much as I can.
When he is gone, the new governor, Kim Reynolds, will have to deal with the second half of this General Assembly and some of the actions that are a result of the first half from the past few months, like the new law changing how the state unions can collectively bargain. This week, another lawsuit is filed against the state about that law.
My name is Tammy Warra. I'm the president of the Iowa State Education Association. And today, on behalf of more than 34,000 education professionals, as well as more than 400 local associations, the Iowa State Education Association and the Davenport Education Association filed a lawsuit challenging the sweeping changes to Iowa's public sector collective bargaining law made by House File 291.
Iowa State Education Association President Tammy Warrow speaks at the Capitol during a press conference on Tuesday. Warrow says the law is unconstitutional because it creates two classes of government workers when it comes to negotiations. The law allows public safety employees to continue negotiating over a wide range of issues, including aspects of employee workplace conditions.
So currently, a fire marshal is able to bargain ways to keep the inside of a firehouse safe. Why can't a teacher bargain ways to keep the inside of a schoolhouse safe? A dispatcher in some locals are able to bargain his or her health insurance, including family coverage. But members of our unit are no longer able to do that. Why are the dispatcher's children more important than ours?
Warrow says the suit isn't about competing for benefits with other public unions.
We do not begrudge our brothers and sisters in other unions for their bargaining rights. To the contrary, we wish for them to keep what they have and for us to have what we used to have.
The ISEA's lawsuit also challenges the new requirements for the voting that determines whether teachers and other public sector workers want to have union representation in the workplace.
The new law establishes an irrational voter universe for recertification elections, and that's based on the total population of members of a bargaining unit in a school district. If a person is unable to vote, doesn't wish to vote, or is physically not available to vote, the law automatically counts their absence vote as a no.
Warrow says if this kind of rule was required for politicians, 51% of the entire state's population not just the people who only vote in the election, would have to vote for the same person, for example, to become a governor. This suit joins another one against the state about the new law filed 2 months ago by the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Union. A long House debate about banning abortions after 20 weeks passes on Wednesday. It came from a bill passed in the Senate 2 weeks ago. The House places new additions that will require the Senate to take a look at it again. The version passing the House this week is more restrictive. On Tuesday evening, the bill's floor manager, Representative Shannon Lundgren, says during the opening remarks she believes a 20-week-old fetus can feel pain.
And maybe even earlier. The central nervous system is developed as early as 4 weeks post-fertilization. We treat an unborn baby just like a born baby when it needs treatment, medication, surgery. We treat an unborn baby like a human being when it is a victim of violence or murder.
She refers to Iowa's non-consensual termination laws, where if a pregnant woman is murdered, the killer can be charged with killing the unborn child.
There is no denying that an unborn baby at 5 months is a human being. There's no denying that babies have survived outside of the womb as early as 20 weeks.
This is the beginning of a debate that will last on this night for 3 hours, 50 minutes, then resume the next day for 2.5 hours. As is often the case, most of the points are made during the discussion of amendments. Now, technically, this whole discussion is one big amendment to the Senate bill. So we're hearing about amendments to a big amendment. To ease the confusion, let's put it in practical terms. Think of the amendments we are about to hear as amendments to the bill. I know it's a little confusing. After all, this is a government thing. The first amendment to be filed is from Representative Lisa Hettins.
With all the bills that have been sponsored this year and actually over my tenure regarding women's reproductive health, Representative Hunter and I bring forth this amendment to ensure that we are providing equal attention to men's health and reproductive capacity.
It's modeled from a bill filed in the Texas legislature 3 weeks ago titled Man's Right to Know Act. It was designed to mirror the state's 2011 measure, a Woman's Right to Know Act, which includes the requirement for patients seeking an abortion to review a pamphlet of the same name 24 hours before the procedure. 20-week abortions have been illegal in Texas for many years. Here in Iowa, this amendment for men contains most of the provisions as the act proposed 3 weeks ago in Texas.
It is to ensure that Iowa men experience safe and healthy elective vasectomy, colonoscopy procedures, and erectile dysfunction approaches. It ensures that a physician may invoke personal, moral, and religious beliefs in refusing to perform any of these elective services, in prescribing drugs, both oral and injections, and sets up the masturbatory emissions and storage program at healthcare and medical facilities to preserve potential life, which could be in jeopardy through the loss of millions, actually tens of millions, of spermatozoa.
Just like in Texas, this legislation is designed to mock proposed abortion restrictions and not become an actual law. The amendment is withdrawn minutes after its introduction. Next, Representative Sandy Salmon introduces an amendment that is also not likely to be passed, but for different reasons.
This amendment says that the right to life for the unborn baby is protected from the time his or her heartbeat is detected. When we detect a heartbeat, we know there is life present. In the same way, when a heartbeat is absent, we know life is not there.
The fetal heartbeat provision was also introduced a week ago during a committee, but was dropped. And here on the floor, the amendment is withdrawn at the conclusion of Representative Salmon's opening remarks. Minutes later, she brings before the body another amendment. This one has support from her party's caucus. It includes requiring a woman seeking an abortion to provide written certification that she has seen an image of her fetus.
A woman must have an ultrasound and be given the opportunity to see her unborn baby, hear his or her heartbeat, and hear a description of her baby.
The next part of the amendment becomes one of the most significant changes to the bill.
The amendment also establishes a 72-hour waiting period after the ultrasound to help a woman consider and make a good, educated decision for herself and her baby.
Only five other states require a 72-hour waiting period from the time the physician gives the woman required information until the time she can have an abortion.
The woman's right to know language is included in the amendment. A woman must be given all the information necessary to make a good decision for herself and her baby, including her options and their effects and the risk factors for each. The Department of Public Health must make available to doctors information on agencies available to help, benefits of adoption, and methods of abortion and their risks.
Representative Amy Nielsen says the amendment does not respect women.
I believe that passing this legislation tells the roughly 1.6 million women in the state of Iowa that they are not intelligent enough to make healthcare decisions for themselves. Forcing women to wait for medical treatment to indulge the sensitivities of others says that she cannot be trusted to make her own healthcare decisions. What medical decisions do we require a man to take 72 hours to consider before he is allowed to receive the treatment?
After an hour of debate, the amendment passes. It's a significant one that adds much to the bill that came over from the Senate. Representative Greg Hartsill introduces a new amendment. It will define life as beginning at conception.
Now, some may counter that the language in this amendment is unconstitutional per their understanding of the U.S. Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision. Well, let's just examine that for a moment. In the Roe decision, Justice Blackmun wrote that if the personhood of the unborn child were ever established by a state, then the case for abortion collapses because the baby's right to life would then be guaranteed by due process under the 14th Amendment.
Anti-abortion groups like the National Pro-Life Alliance believe the passage of life at conception laws can overturn the Roe v. Wade decision. Although in Iowa this kind of law doesn't have support to pass, it's being brought up to show there are members of the Republican caucus who will support this effort.
While this issue is very important, one for our culture to resolve, I understand that this body is not prepared to deal with it this evening. So with a heavy heart, Madam Speaker, I ask for unanimous consent to withdraw Amendment H-1270.
As the discussion moves on, two lines of the bill are of great concern to Representative Brian Meyer, words that may be interpreted as something closer to life begins at conception. These lines read, "Nothing in this chapter shall be constructed as determining life to begin at 20-week post-fertilization. Instead, it is recognized that life begins at fertilization." Representative Meyer asks the bill's floor manager, Representative Shannon Lundgren, to explain this language.
Line one and two, what am I missing?
Again, that is just a statement of purpose, not
there's
of
no
intent.
Such thing as a, you understand there's no such thing as a statement of purpose in the code. You put language in the code that says this is what the law is, correct?
There is no force of law in this statement. There are no civil penalties attached to the language.
There's no force of law. Why would you put it in the code if there's no force of law?
Again, it is a statement.
Where does it say that it's a statement? What is the statement of purpose that you speak of? Where does it state?
We as a caucus are acknowledging that we believe that life does begin at conception.
But you put it in the code that life begins at fertilization. It is recognized that life begins at fertilization, correct? That's what the code says right now if we pass this bill.
As a statement of purpose, not intent.
Okay. Explain to me what the state of... What does that even mean?
We're making a statement that we believe that life begins at conception.
Representative Meyer and Representative Lundgren continue going round and round about how the language is or isn't a statement of purpose and what this could mean for enforcement.
Give me an example of a statement of purpose or other intent that's in the code.
Well, I could read the exact language that you're referring to. That is a statement of purpose, not of intent.
You're telling me it's a statement of purpose.
I am.
You're aware that courts interpret statutes all the time, correct?
I'm not an attorney and I'm not a judge.
Okay. So courts don't interpret statutes then at all, ever?
Could be.
Could be. Really? Do you know anything about the bill that you're running? Because let me tell you, Representative Lundgren, let me ask you another question. So you're saying that this has no, absolutely no control of law?
There's no force of law in this statement. There are no civil penalties tied to this language. Okay. It is just certainly a statement of purpose, not intent.
Representative Meyer calls upon Representative Wes Breckenridge, who is a lieutenant in a police department.
Do you know of any place in the Iowa Code that has a statement of purpose and not a force of law?
No, I'm not aware of that. Once it's in the code, it's interpreted by the judge.
Right, but if you're familiar with the code and if something is stated such as it is in page 7, what is your interpretation of what's stated there in page 7?
As I look at that, if somebody indicates that life begins at fertilization, any other code that is connected to that could be considered a crime on a life.
Debate continues for another 45 minutes on Tuesday night, but around 10:30, the legislation is deferred. The House Rules State debate cannot take place between midnight and 8 a.m. It resumes the next afternoon, and a new amendment is introduced that clarifies the concerns Representative Meyer has about language the floor manager says is a statement of purpose. The new amendment is presented by Representative Joel Fry.
And in this amendment, it is clearly written and identified that the intent of the General Assembly is to enact policies that protect all unborn life. The second piece of that amendment then goes on to clarify that it shall not be interpreted to create or recognize a right to an abortion or to prohibit abortion prior to an unborn child reaching the post-fertilization age of 20 weeks.
Representative Meyer offers his thanks to the Republicans for the amendment.
I also like to thank the majority party for recognizing the fact that the previous language did have the force of law.
It is brought to a voice vote.
All those in favor of the amendment shall say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed shall say no. The ayes appear to have it, the ayes do have it, and the amendment is adopted.
The legislation now makes it illegal for abortions to happen after 20 weeks, except in the case to save the life of the mother. It does not allow abortions after 20 weeks in the case of fetal anomalies, rape, or incest. Representative Abby Finkenauer shares a letter with the body about a family that decided to terminate a pregnancy after 20 weeks when it was determined the fetus had a misshapen brain and physical problems. Representative Finkenauer says, if she is ever a mother going through the same kind of thing in the future, she doesn't want this legislation to be an obstacle.
Today, we aren't just standing on the floor of the Iowa House. We are standing in the doctor's office of those future pregnant women and standing there listening to one of the hardest things they've ever had to hear. When they hear that their very wanted baby, their dreams are going to be very different than they had ever imagined. One where they're told possibly that it might not even survive to gestation. But yeah, we're gonna tell them what to do with their body. Please think about what you're doing here today. You guys have your choices, you do. Let's keep it that way. I respect your opinions. I respect your beliefs. Respect me. Respect women. Respect their opinions, their beliefs, and respect the fact that they have the knowledge with their doctor and with their families to make these decisions. Get out of the doctor's offices today and vote no.
Representative Ralph Watts is a supporter of this legislation, but he wishes it would prevent more abortions.
While this bill does not go far enough to protect the unborn, it seems like it's the best we can do at this point. And I must support it to provide a voice for just a few more children.
During closing remarks, floor manager Shannon Lundgren emphasizes this version of the bill's lack of exception for an abortion except in the case of saving the mother's life.
It's beyond my comprehension why we would end a life because it's not perfect, because he or she's chance of survival is low, because it's an inconvenience, or because simply they're not wanted. This amendment does save babies' lives and still protects the life and health of the mother.
The final vote is 55-4, 41 against. It's mostly on party lines, with the only exception of one Republican voting against it. The bill goes back to the Senate for changes to be approved, which they are expected to do. If the governor approves, it will become law the moment he signs it. This is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the Iowa legislature. I'm John Pimble. Two of Iowa's 99 county auditors say a directive from Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate to verify the status of felons in a state voter registration database is an expensive and legally burdensome unfunded mandate. Early this year, counties were told they would receive instructions for processing voter records to determine if any felons were illegally registered to vote. Counties received these directions Monday. Johnson County Auditor Travis Weipert says this new responsibility will consume a lot of time and money. He says it shifts the legal onus of evaluating someone's voting eligibility onto the counties.
You know, we already have the Secretary of State's office doing this job, and now you're going to hand it down and let 99 different people and their staffs administer it? I mean, to me, it just seems like you're opening up a can of worms.
The Secretary of State's office says the disposition of individual voter records always lies with county auditors. The state previously issued a list of people ineligible for voting, which counties relied on during elections. Now, counties are directed to verify the accuracy of any potential match from a database maintained by the Office of the State Court Administration. This database cross-checks felons with voter rolls by matching information like name and date of birth. The additional step of match verification places the final determination of someone's voter eligibility at the county level. A tax credit that benefits Iowa's lowest-paid workers is being spared as lawmakers try to reduce the number of tax credits so there can be more money coming to the state. The list of tax credits under scrutiny cost the state treasury more than $400 million a year. Earned income tax credits take up $71 million. Under an earned income tax credit, Iowans who file a tax return on a very low income get a payment from the government rather than owing a tax bill. Representative Pat Grassley says he heard from advocates for low-income Iowans and others to keep this credit.
The vote that you would have to take and the savings that would be there on all these tax credits, you have to weigh how difficult of a vote that is versus the savings that you're going to achieve. And I just think at this point, there wasn't the appetite to take that up.
Representative Chris Hall says he is glad this credit is staying.
The earned income tax credit helps the low end of the economic spectrum and people who are working 40 hours a week. And it is proven time and time again by many studies to be one of the most effective programs in getting people to work.
Hundreds of millions of dollars in various tax credits for business and industry and a wide range of other recipients remain under scrutiny at the State House. Potential funding cuts at the state and federal levels are looming over organizations that provide services to victims of sexual violence. A cut to state funding for victim services is being discussed as a way to help make up for a budget shortfall. Executive Director Adam Robinson of the Rape Victim Advocacy Program says these cuts would be catastrophic for victim services.
In addition to sexual assault centers like ours, our partner centers and sister centers throughout the state that provide support and advocacy and prevention for survivors of domestic violence, as well as shelter services, are all right now facing a potential threat.
Specific budget cuts haven't been revealed, but similar programs throughout the state and country are bracing for the possibility. Soon, Iowa lawmakers will be required to pay for part of their state-sponsored health insurance, some as much as $300 a month. Since 2013, some legislators have been paying the union employee rate of $20 per month instead of paying 20% of the premium cost, just as non-contract executive branch employees do. This issue came to the attention of the legislature through a Des Moines Register story. Republican Representative Guy Vanderlinden claims the paper's reporting on the subject is unfair.
House Republicans have passed legislation to take care of this issue numerous times since 2011, and it always died in the Democrat-controlled Senate. So to blame House Republicans for any delay seems to me to be disingenuous.
The bill passed 50-0 in the Senate 2 months ago, and this week the House voted with 98 yes and 2 not voting. This is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the Iowa legislative session. Each week we try to find exchanges between lawmakers to give you a better understanding of the process within the chambers. This week, the passage of abortion restrictions is one of many efforts by Republicans this year to change the laws about this procedure. It's likely to come up again in the form of the budget, as the allocation of state funding to organizations like Planned Parenthood have yet to be finalized before legislators end the session. Presumably, this is happening this month. The concept for Under the Golden Dome comes from Iowa Public Radio News Program Director Catherine Perkins. Editorial support from News Director Michael Leland. Stories for today's show come from Joyce Russell, Sarah Bowden, Pat Blank, Katerina Sestarik, and Radio Iowa's Kay Henderson. This is week 13, and we will keep our microphones pointed toward the lawmakers and bring you more legislative highlights when we release week 14 next Friday afternoon from iowapublicradio.org. I'm John Pimble.